Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Tom Verton, Chief Operating Officer of Silicon Valley Bank and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Robert Heller. He has had a remarkable career in business, government, and education. After obtaining his Ph.D. in economics from UC Berkeley in 1965, he began his career as a professor of economics at UCLA. In 1974, he joined the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. In 1978, he served as director of international economic research at Bank of America in San Francisco. Dr. Heller was appointed in 1986 by President Reagan to the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Returning to the private sector in 1989, he joined Visa International. 2 years later, he was appointed CEO of Visa USA. By the way, I spoke yesterday with the former CEO of MasterCard, who served concurrently with Dr. Heller. He called Dr. Heller a fierce competitor and holds him in very high regard. Dr. Heller retired from the Fair Isaac Corporation in 2002, where he was an executive vice president and member of the board. Dr. Heller has published 7 books and over 100 articles on economics, finance, and business. He is also an active civic leader in Marin County and has served on the boards of many educational and cultural institutions. He also serves as a rear commodore of the San Francisco Yacht Club. Please welcome Dr. Robert Heller.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here again at the Commonwealth Club. I think the loss of confidence triggered by the collapse of some of our largest financial institutions is perhaps the single most important factor holding us back from a healthy recovery. Because after the failure of the Lehman Brothers enterprise, securities markets froze up and banks were no longer willing to lend to each other. Instead, the individual and institutional investors alike sought refuge in the safety of treasury bills and accounts insured by the government. And as the financial markets froze up, the recession that was triggered by the bursting of the housing bubble instantly deepened and spread to other sectors of the economy like wildfire. So, in the current crisis, almost the entire investment banking sector has been wiped out, and the largest investment houses are now operating under a commercial banking charter. The too-big-to-fail doctrine was put to the test not just once, but several times by the threatened failure of our largest financial institutions. The Federal Reserve, as well as the government, had to develop new and innovative techniques to deal with the financial problems threatening the health of the entire economy. And the same was true around the entire world as financial turmoil and economic recession led to the first measured decline in world GDP since World War II. And I think while it is tempting to see the current crisis as a unique event in our lifetime, because of the severity of the housing and stock market collapse, financial crises have occurred just about once every single decade since the founding of the Republic. You will all remember the recession of the early 1980s, the SNL housing debacle of the early 90s, and the bursting of the internet bubble in 2000 and 2001. Well, I think we can be pretty sure that history will repeat itself again. Nevertheless, we should draw certain conclusions from our existing problems and try to build a financial system that is much stronger for the future. Restoring confidence in financial markets is clearly one of the highest priorities, because without a functioning financial transaction mechanism, the real economy will not be able to recover, and gather speed again. So at present, the U.S. economy resembles a little bit of a bicyclist who is pedaling furiously, trying to make progress, while the financial services chain is broken. Little of the impetus provided by the Federal Reserve and the government has reached the economy's driving wheel so far. And while President Obama and Chairman Bernanke seem to be pedaling furiously, the economy is still at a standstill. So, if I were to be granted three wishes on what financial reforms should be implemented to restore confidence, what would that be? I believe we should focus on building safer banks, safer markets, and a safer retirement system. In particular, let us remove much of the uncertainty now besetting the financial system. And by restoring confidence, we can bring true long-term investors back from the sidelines so that their funds and investments will again propel the economy forward. The American banking system has undergone several transformations in recent decades, and shaped by the reforms enacted in the middle of the Great Depression, the U.S. banking system was highly fragmented and insular along geographic and functional lines. The McFadden Act of 1927 prohibited interstate branch banking, and so the country's banking system was essentially composed out of 50 separate banking systems. And furthermore, the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 separated commercial and investment banking. This fragmented banking system made it impossible to diversify risk, which is absolutely essential to ensure safety. And furthermore, with the increasing integration of the national and international economy, the need to serve banking clients in all parts of the country grew, and hence a national banking network was really absolutely necessary for the nation's prosperity. And that realization resulted in the abolition of the interstate banking barriers and the elimination of the rules separating commercial and investment banking in the 1990s. The new universal banks were able then to serve both commercial and investment clients, and they helped fuel the economic boom of the 1990s and the early part of the 21st century. So I believe that the current crisis would have been much worse if these universal banks had not been in place when the housing slump of 2007 hit. Just remember that during the last housing crisis, the bust of the late 80s and early 90s, over 1,000 banks and 1,500 SNLs failed, essentially wiping out the whole entire SNL industry. That is, a total of 2,500 financial institutions failed during that episode 2 decades ago. And compare that to the current tally of only 50 banks' failure so far. Clearly, things could have been worse. But at the same time, the investment banking industry has undergone a radical transformation. In the last 2 years, the 6 largest investment banks have either gone out of business, like Lehman Brothers, have merged into large commercial banks, like Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch, or have converted their charters into bank holding companies, such as Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley did. But in the process, we spawned an entirely new phenomenon by the creation of the new nationwide banking behemoths, the too-big-to-fail institutions. So we got to ask ourselves, which one is worse, having 2,500 financial institutions fail, as happened in the late 80s and early 90s, or having all the large banks of the country on government life support, as is happening right now? I think banking is not an inherently dangerous business. I've spent most of my life in the banking industry and with bankers. Most of them are pretty conservative, dull, and maybe even a bit boring. But every now and then, you find a young genius who exhibits flashes of brilliance and earns the bank large sums of money by daring speculative trades in the foreign exchange, futures, or derivative markets. And after receiving bonuses in excess of $5 million per year for several years in a row, one such trader was fired last year after he lost the bank $5 billion. That's with a B. His string of luck had finally run out. The bank was left holding the bag and had to absorb the enormous losses. Well, one of the key reasons for the sharp fluctuations in bank income these days are trading losses and gains. And it's therefore proper to ask, at least briefly, why do banks engage in these activities? Clearly, there's a legitimate reason for banks to engage in trading on behalf of their clients. They can earn a small but secure profit on each transaction that they execute on behalf of the client. And in these trading activities, banks earn a profit just like a real estate broker earns a commission for bringing buyers and sellers together. But banks sometimes take speculative positions on behalf of the bank itself. And with these positions, they put the bank's own capital at risk. And they do so often in a highly leveraged way. If the bet pays off, the banks make a profit. If the trader loses the bet, the bank absorbs the loss. And that position taking is akin to a real estate broker who buys a house in the hope that he or she can flip it very quickly and sell it to another buyer. But now the broker has its own capital at risk, and if he has borrowed to finance that transaction, he may be highly leveraged, and the chance of losing all or most of his capital is vastly increased. And that's the same with bank traders, who put the bank's capital at risk by holding speculative positions in financial markets. That's probably why Bank of America's stock plunged 24% last week when the bank announced vastly improved earnings of over $4 billion for the first quarter. These earnings greatly exceeded the expectations of analysts, but the earnings came mainly from trading operations that investors saw as highly speculative and uncertain, and consequently, the stock got punished. In essence, the traders were speculating with the bank's capital, and the holders of that capital, the owners of that capital, did not like it. Because if the trader's bet pays off, he stands to gain a large bonus. If it doesn't, the shareholders are on the hook. And that scenario no longer plays well. But because the government serves as the ultimate guarantee of the safety of the bank deposits through the FDIC, the regulators also have a profound interest in minimizing the bank's risk exposure. So let me emphasize that I believe that reenacting the Glass-Steagall Act, separating commercial from investment banking, would not be a good idea. Instead, fencing off the deposit-taking banking institution from the risk-taking banking institution, from the traders who like to take the speculative bets that often amount to gambling, that would make much more sense. So the result would be universal banks that can serve all the needs of their commercial and investment-oriented customers. And as a consequence, on the other hand, there would probably emerge a different set of institutions that would cater to those who want to take these speculative risks. They may combine the risk-taking activities taken nowadays by hedge funds and the proprietary trading activities of the banks. That is, deposit-taking institutions and risk-taking institutions would be separated from each other. And as Congress and the administration consider banking reform, they may well focus on this division and limit much more sharply the extent to which banks can take large risks by incurring speculative open positions in their trading operations. Next, let me turn to the stock market. The vast majority of all stocks are held by investors who are either individuals saving for their retirement, as well as pension and trust funds that have much the same purpose, namely to invest funds to achieve a prudent return for their investors. And many mutual funds also belong into this category. Safety and a reasonable rate of return are probably the primary objectives of these investors. And there are very explicit rules that individuals and money managers have to observe in these IRA, 401k, KIO, and SEP accounts. Namely, they are bound by these so-called prudent investor rules that do not permit short sales or purchases on margin in these accounts. Most derivatives are also off limits. And the same is true for many institutions such as pension funds, insurance companies, trust companies, and other investors that are often required by law or by charter to adhere to a prudent man standard. That is, the majority of all participants in the stock market are probably long-term oriented investors that supply capital to a hopefully thriving economy. But enter the hedge fund managers, program traders, and other short-termers that devise fancy mathematical models and short-term trading strategies, and the previously safe road to retirement takes on a much more dangerous dimension. It is difficult to argue that these market operators really increase the overall earned by the corporations in which they invest, the IBMs, General Motors, and Chevrons of this world. These traders just hope to exploit the small market inefficiencies and be a bit faster in buying and selling securities than the long-term investors. And they will change investment vehicles frequently, sometimes every few minutes or even every seconds, and thereby hope to garner a significant slice of the available economic pie. But does this help the long-term investor who is investing in the same stocks and bonds and who does not have these opportunities of short selling and margin buying? I find it very hard to see any evidence for that. Some may argue that these traders increase liquidity in the markets, and that may well be true. But engaging in large amount of day trading and quick in and out selling and buying, these short-term operators also increase the volatility and thereby enhance uncertainty. And by taking advantage of short-term profit opportunities, they tend to take away part of the economic return that would otherwise accrue to the buy and hold investors. So, what's the solution? I would like to propose a new set of trading rules that can be freely and voluntarily adopted by the corporations issuing these securities. If the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ do not want to permit these new rules, we may want to start an entirely new market where all these securities are traded under these rules. We may simply call it the Prudent Investors Exchange, or PI for short. Simple as apple pie. Under these prudent investor rules, there will be no short sales, no purchase of securities on margin, just plain vanilla stock and bond trades are allowed. Mind you, as I said before, these are essentially the same rules that you, in your IRA and KIO accounts, have to observe right now. Similarly, professional managers in pension and trust funds investing under the prudent man rule have to invest under these restrictions. Thus, there will be plenty of natural investors who will be attracted to these securities, and I would not expect a shortage of demand for these types of products. In addition, I would impose a minimum holding period of 1 week for these securities to eliminate the day traders and to provide a level playing field and more security to the long-term investors who are not able to spend the entire day on their computer screens and their trading desk. Would that be an onerous restriction? I doubt it. Again, almost all your 401k retirements, that I know of at least, you are not allowed to trade your asset composition, change your asset composition more than once a month. So that's nothing new either. Furthermore, most hedge funds will not allow you to buy or sell them more than once a quarter, once every 3 months, or even less frequently. And those are supposed to be the smartest market operators on the planet. Obviously, they know what's good for them. All I say is, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, namely the average investor. Let's not tie the hands of the retirement investor just so that they're easy prey for the speculators. Let's establish a fair and level playing field with the same rules for all. So let me repeat once more the prudent investor exchange rules. No short sales, no margin, 1 week holding period, and the freedom for each corporation to list the securities under these new rules. I already said that many securities in retirement accounts are already subject to these rules, so there will be a natural demand for these securities. But would corporations want to list their securities under these trading rules? In other words, would there be a supply of such instruments? I recently presented this proposal to a group of about a dozen chief financial officers of some of the largest corporations, and you would recognize all their names instantly. At the end of the presentation, I asked for a show of hands. Who might be interested in listing his company's stock on such an exchange? And guess what? All hands went up. I was amazed. I must admit, however, that no financial institutions, stockbrokers, or banks were represented among the CFOs around the table. And maybe the result would have been a little different, at least not as unanimous. Well, I would expect that corporations that want access to the funds of prudent investors, conservative mutual funds, pension funds, and similar institutions that are bound by the prudent man rule to list on the pie. Confidence would be boosted, investors would return to the markets, so that corporations would again have access to the investment funds needed to restore growth and prosperity. But clearly, the prudent investor rules would not eliminate all fluctuations in the stock market. But events such as the financial panic of last fall, when speculative short sellers amounted to about 70%, that's right, 70% of the entire trading volume in some stocks, and whose value plunged consequently by 50% or more in just a few days, that hopefully would be a thing of the past. So let me turn to my last proposal, which is designed to improve the safety and security of our retirement arrangements. The recent drop in the stock market has decimated the individual retirement account on which many Americans now depend. And decades ago, most Americans retired with a defined pension benefit from their employer. And that financial security was based on lifetime employment by one company and the slow buildup of financial assets in that company's retirement account. Since then, two changes in the economic and social environment have brought about a radical change in the security and confidence with which Americans approach retirement. For one, companies faced with ever-increasing pension obligations have shifted from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans. Think of the enormous pension burden shouldered by companies like General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, and you get the picture. Second, most employees have become much more mobile, shifting between jobs every few years, and consequently, many individuals have forfeited their retirement benefits because they did not reach the vesting threshold as far as their own longevity in the corporation is concerned. So if you look at the average retiree without a sufficient company pension, and I think that represents the majority of people right now, you see a person who relies upon two financial resources for retirement. First of all, there's Social Security, and second, they're your own savings. Social Security is basically a social safety net that provides a maximum benefit of $2,323 per month for those retirees that have worked most of their lifetime. Here in San Francisco, that may be just enough to pay the rent. So most people have to supplement their Social Security income by private savings. But how much is enough for that purpose? That's the most difficult question to answer. And if you would ask five financial advisors the same question, I bet you would get five very different answers. First of all, and most important, you must know how long you will live. Clearly, you'll need more money if you're going to live until 80 than if you die at 70. But you're sure you won't be around until year 100? And at that age, your earnings capacity certainly is not very great. I don't want to scare you, but the world record in that department is 122 years that was set by a French lady. And while you may have no ambition to exceed that record, the lesson to be learned is that you have to accumulate enough money to last your entire lifetime, never mind how long you will live. And all the money left over will go to your relatives and friends, unless the government taxes it first. And who wants to accumulate money for that purpose? Second, you don't know the rate of return on that retirement money. If you invest in the stock or bond market, you may be unlucky if the market happens to turn sour and you lose 30 or 50% of your lifetime savings in a few weeks. So again, you will have to oversave to guard against the possibility of market fluctuations. And again, your descendants or the tax man will be the main beneficiaries. So the way out of that dilemma may consist of a retirement arrangement that involves the following components. First, all employees pay a certain percentage of their salary during their entire working life into a common insurance fund, one fund for all. Second, the funds are invested in a prudent manner in a balanced portfolio of stocks, bonds, and inflation-protected treasury securities. And third, at retirement age, the fund calculates a lifetime annuity for the recipient, which is then paid out in the form of an inflation-protected annuity, lifetime. Such a arrangement would provide portable, lifetime, inflation-protected income for all retirees and thereby enhance the confidence with which people can finance their retirement. Again, I'm not reinventing the wheel here, but merely advocate a general system similar to the University of California Retirement System, or CalPERS, which provides the pensions for public employees like teachers, judges, legislators, and so on. In turn, the new retirement fund could place its investment in the stocks and bonds securely traded on the prudent investor exchange that I have described earlier. So in closing, let me summarize the three main suggestions for restoring confidence in the financial sector. First, let us take steps to sharply limit or even eliminate the capacity of depository institutions like banks to take speculative trade positions. Second, allow corporations to choose a set of rules under which their securities are traded, including a set of prudent investor rules which will eliminate purchases on margin and short sales and that require a minimum holding period of 1 week for these securities. Third, let us work towards the establishment of a safe pension system that is based on portable contributions and that will pay secure lifetime annuities. I believe that these three steps will restore confidence in our financial system and will bring investors back into our capital markets so that the current gridlock in the financial system is broken and people can again invest with confidence in their future and in our economy. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Robert Heller, former governor of the Federal Reserve Board, as well as former president of Visa USA, for his comments this evening. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, former president of Charles Schwab Investment Management and member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I will be moderating today's audience question period. And Dr. Heller, we have a number of questions, so let's begin in the time that we have. To your question about the secondary market, the second market that you talked about, if this is a very direct question and very pointed question, if Fidelity and CalPERS, for example, want to sell on the same day, who will make the bid on something like that, given the size of their trades?
Very good question. It may well be that Fidelity, or if they want to really sell a large volume of shares in a particular mutual fund, will not be able to do all those trades exactly at the same moment. Instead, they will have to space it out over a certain period of time as the liquidity of that market permits. You can't have it all. There are quite a few small companies in the United States that have thinly traded markets. And if you observe their stocks, their fluctuations aren't any bigger than those fluctuations of the large, well-capitalized stocks where there is a very large trading volume. People instead, with the help of brokers like Fidelity, like Schwab, learn to space out their trades, and as a result, it takes a little bit longer, but they're still able to accomplish their purpose.
Great. Thank you. Okay, we've got several questions on Obama and the economy. So today marks 100 days for President Obama. How do you grade his actions related to the economic crisis? And the second question related to that, would the Republicans have handled the crisis more effectively?
I think Geithner, Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, was already very heavily involved in the current economic situation when he was president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And as such, he was involved right from the beginning in the bailouts of several of the large investment banks that we just talked about. So now he is sitting on the other side of the table as Secretary of the Treasury, no longer at the Federal Reserve. Geithner himself hasn't changed much as a result, and I don't think government policy hasn't changed much as a result. The Federal Reserve has been involved all the way through with the same cast of characters as before. So as far as the current economic crisis is concerned, not much has changed. But President Obama, in addition, has also said that he wants to engage in a transformation of the American economy. And if you look very carefully at his new proposed budget, which he just submitted, you see that a lot of the money is not really directed towards shovel-ready projects, as they have come to be called, but instead they are directed towards things like more research for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, more money for the State Department, which has an astounding increase of over 40% in its budget. Shows you the importance of Hillary Clinton, but I doubt that it will do an awful lot in the short run for the health of the American economy. So most of the money that has been put into place in the fiscal aspects of the policy that has been adopted, most of that money will only become effective 2011, 2012, and if we at that moment still need that stimulus, we're indeed in very much more trouble than I think we are actually in. So the timing of these projects is not what Larry Summers, who is one of his key advisors, initially set out that all these projects should fulfill, namely to be timely, temporary, and targeted. I think a lot more needs to be done to pull that economic stimulus on the fiscal side forward rather than direct it towards these long-term social projects that the Obama administration wants to accomplish.
Thank you. Turning to the banks and the confidence you described, how much confidence should people have in large banks right now? And I think we received a lot of questions asking about B of A's Ken Lewis being ousted as chairman, running as CEO, the latest stockholder votes.
I think the big banks clearly are as safe as they were last year, as they were 2 years ago, because ultimately for people who want to put the money into the banks, the importance is the government guarantee, the FDIC guarantee that stands behind the deposits. As a matter of fact, the FDIC has lifted its ceiling for deposit insurance from $100,000 permanently to $200,000 and temporarily unlimited. So at the moment, the banks are absolutely safe, but they're also under government, much more government control than they were before. As far as Mr. Lewis is concerned, I think it is just generally good corporate practice to separate the role of the CEO and the chairman of the board. In the U.S., we tend to combine quite often three titles, chairman, president, and CEO. Many corporations have for a long time separated the role of chairman and of CEO. And I think that is good corporate governance, and that's what Bank of America adopted today. And so they're on the right track.
Great. Well, along those lines, how much of a chance is there that banks will be nationalized? And this leads to the question of should we prevent the too large to fail banks from forming? In other words, should we break up what we have today?
Yeah, another very good question. First of all, the nationalization. I think nobody wants nationalized banks. Secretary Geithner has said he is opposed to nationalized banks. Nationalized banks would take us back to the days of the Soviet Union when they ran all the banks, and basically that was a dismal failure. So private banks, that's the way to go. But some of the banks right now that have taken the so-called TARP money, they are partly owned by the government. And in the future, as the government has the power to exercise the warrants that they have received, they will become even more owned by the government. If I have my data right, Citibank right now will be roughly one-third owned by the federal government. That's a very large share of ownership for any one institution to own in another institution. So they will exercise absolute power almost over the future of that particular financial institution. Look at the other side. Who will they lend to? They will be lending then to a General Motors and a Chrysler, both of which may, not yet, but may well be owned to a large part of by the government. So here you have the spectre of the government lending to the government. What can be less efficient than an arrangement like that? I sure hope that we will stay away from nationalizing banks and having a very large amount of government ownership in these banks. Some of the stimulus measures were clearly necessary, and so we just hope that they will be very temporary.
Do you think the banks should be broken up?
Should the very large banks be broken up? First of all, I said already that I don't like having trading activities, speculative trading activities, on behalf of the bank in that institution. So I would move those activities out of the banks. Do we need large banks? The answer there is clearly yes. We not only need large banks, but we need truly global banks, because commerce these days truly has become a global matter. And as corporations are more intertwined, the banks serving these corporations must be also present on a global scale, not only on a national scale. And by definition, those institutions will have to be large. Whether they are based in the United States or abroad, that question is, I guess, irrelevant for these purposes. They could be based in both places, but they also need good supervision and regulation, and therefore a more uniform supervisory and regulatory system than we have at the present time. I don't think there will be a global regulator, but individual national regulation will have to become a bit more comprehensive and globally oriented.
Great. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Heller, former member of the Federal Reserve Board, who is discussing his vision for restoring confidence in financial markets. We have a couple more questions around banking, specifically the stress test. So it's been reported that the Fed stress tests on banks say that at least 6 of the 19 largest U.S. banks need to raise more capital. What does this mean?
Well, first of all, the stress tests, the banks internally conduct these tests all the time, or at least on a quarterly basis. Namely, they run various scenarios. What would happen to the bank's earnings if interest rates would go higher or lower, if loan losses would become higher or lower? And all the banks, all the good banks that I know, will run these kinds of scenarios or stress tests. Here now, the government conducted a similar set of stress tests for various banks at the same time. And according to these, we haven't heard the actual results, but rumor has it that some banks would be in need of more capital if the worst assumptions assumed in these stress tests would come true. Well, that's a good exercise to engage in. It's always good to know what the worst possible outcome would be. And therefore, you know, I'm all in favor of having more bank capital in these banking institutions. The problem really with capital and capital regulation is what a lot of the regulators have done in the past, and that is they will not permit banks to build up excess reserves or very large reserves during the good times. And then in the bad times, when the banks incur losses, then the regulators step up to ask the bank and say, well, now you should have more capital because times are tough. I think where we should move to, and it's a difficult thing to do, but it's a direction I would try to move to, would be towards a counter-cyclical capital requirement. When times are good, you would encourage the banks to pile on more capital, a little cushion, a little bit of fat that isn't necessary in those particular times. And then they would be able to draw down on these cushions during the lean times. In the good old days of banking, banks used to do that a little surreptitiously. They had a little quiet reserve here or a little quiet reserve there that they could liquidate. But with the increasing openness and the accounting standards that we have implemented, all these sort of quiet or hidden reserves have disappeared. Now everybody knows everything, and as a result, you try to run as close to the capital requirement as possible, and you don't have that little extra cushion that you could use in lean times.
Great, thank you. We have a couple of questions around media and their culpability in the crisis. So how culpable are the media for being too much of a corporate cheerleader and not questioning financial firms leading up to this crisis? And on the other hand, did the press overplay the conflict of TARP money receiving banks and bonus payments to their executives? So the first part of the question, their role in contributing to the financial crisis.
Well, when times are good, everybody can be a cheerleader. But I think bankers and bank supervisors should be wary of the times when things are very good. It reminds me of the days when our children were very young and usually made a lot of noise. But sometimes it would get very quiet upstairs. And my wife would yell at them, "Whatever you're doing up there, stop it." That's the same with banking. When things are going very well, you have a large group of cheerleaders. That's the moment to sit back and, like we said before, maybe accumulate some extra reserves so that you'll be prepared for the bad times. I think the media have reported what they saw right in front of them, and it's not really up to the media to question or to impose additional rules. That's the role of bank management, and that is the role of the bank regulators. And what's the second one?
So did the press overplay the conflict of TARP money being received by the banks and the bonus payments to their executives?
Oh, tough question. TARP money and the bonus payments to the executives. Clearly, when a bank is in deep trouble and is losing money overall, senior management, in my mind, does not deserve large bonuses. That's just, again, good corporate governance. Sometimes there are situations where, you know, somebody may be leaving the bank and you got to retain them, and especially when the bank is in difficulties, then the need to retain these experts in one field or another becomes very large. And therefore you want to pay retention bonuses. I would pay all these retention bonuses if the people want to be retained. Presumably they're going to have to be there a year or two from now. So pay them in the stock of that particular institution and have a 2, 3, 4 year vesting period, and then you're sure that they will be there, rather than giving them cash bonuses right now for something that they hopefully will turn better. But senior bank management, I think, also should be compensated to a great extent by restricted stock that will vest over a period of years, and that way you align the long-term interests of the shareholders and of management much better than by big cash bonuses.
Going back to your vision, how do you view financial vehicles like auction rate securities in your new model, and how do you think regulators should deal with them?
The derivative instruments that have become popular in recent years, many of them serve a useful purpose, have been designed to serve a useful purpose, but I think that useful purpose was often perverted by people seeing these instruments and saying, oh, this will allow me to place a bet on whether Bank A or Corporation B will actually default on their debt situation. So I see something happening right now. Companies getting in a little bit of trouble, and I buy some of these debt default swaps. Or, on the other hand, there were a lot of corporations around, like AIG, who thought, gee, there's very little risk in all these, in writing these derivatives, offering other clients these options, because nothing has happened for the last 4 or 5 years. Nobody has gone broke. Nobody has defaulted on this mortgage. So they looked at their fancy economic models, mathematical equations, looked back and say, oh, risk is very, very small. but the future risk was not small at all. And so for very little money, they made these bets, they placed the bets, and then eventually they had to be paid off. You know, so that's the same thing like a gambling casino. You know, every 36th turn of the wheel, number seven will turn up. And then number seven came up last year, and the companies that were writing these instruments were losing, and somebody else on the other side was gaining. Overall, I think it is moving more towards gambling if you are not using them to cover a natural economic open position.
And do you think new regulations need to be crafted for that?
Definitely. I think the banks have no business in writing large volumes of these highly speculative open positions. Look what happened to AIG. The basic business of AIG, the insurance business, was apparently sound and well managed. And then a couple of people over at the financial products division in London started to engage in all these derivative trading and mortgage-backed security derivative trading, and that led to enormous exposures towards other financial institutions and eventually the demise of the entire company. You should not let one small trading operation put the entire bank or insurance company at risk.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Heller, former member of the Federal Reserve Board, who is discussing his vision for restoring confidence in financial markets. Now, I had a lot of questions on your prognosis around investing and the economy. So let me attack the first one, which is around the housing market. A lot of real estate is not selling because many banks have imposed rules on the qualified loans for borrowers. So could you comment on that? And, you know, it seems until it loosens up, the housing and commercial real estate market will not normalize. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, there's clearly still an overhang of unsold houses in the market, especially in certain markets, California, Arizona, Florida, where there was a lot of speculative building initially, and those buildings have not found an ultimate owner, a person who actually wants to live in these places. They were largely built because the speculation, if I buy this now, then 2 months from now I can sell it at 10 or 20% profit. That game clearly is up. On the other hand, at the present time, if you're a first-time home buyer, I think it's probably an excellent time to buy. If you find one of those houses or apartments or condos, that is on the market right now. I remember, 15, 20 years ago, one of my co-workers, a very smart lady, she'd gotten very rich because she had invested in the late 1980s in Texas homes, bought them for $25,000 apiece, and they had become, 10 times as much worth. And if you look at real estate now, Stockton, Modesto, where the markets have really gone down drastically, if you do it right and if you're willing to live in these houses and that's where you want to be, this is the best time to buy.
I think the question was around the lending, restricting of the lending standards that the banks are imposing now, which makes it harder for people to get in.
True. And that's, I think, many of the programs by the president are designed to ease those standards. And that by the Federal Reserve buying up a lot of the mortgages that have been generated in that process, I think Fannie and Freddie, with all their faults, at the moment they are lending. So if you can live in a house that is, you can buy it with a $700,000 mortgage. That is roughly the limit right now that they will finance. That is the right way, and that's where the administration is doing a good job in trying to break that particular logjam.
Great. Okay. Do you anticipate a period of rapid inflation, and if so, when?
Excellent question. Clearly, the Federal Reserve has been pumping money since September of last year into the system at a very rapid clip. Roughly 20% annual rate has been the increase in the money supply. So there is a lot of fuel out there that could ignite inflation. At the moment, however, we are sitting in what economists like to call a liquidity trap, where people are not, where there's so much liquidity in the system, but nobody is really wanting to use the money, and therefore the economy, just like the bicyclist that I talked about before, who is pedaling furiously, isn't making any progress. So once the economy starts to grow, it will be very difficult for the Federal Reserve to pull out all that monetary stimulus at a very quick pace and not hurt the economy at that time. The Fed's job in that endeavor will be made a lot more difficult by the huge federal government deficits that we are going to be running this year, next year, and the following year. Last year, we had a 3% federal deficit. This year, it's projected at 12%, and next year and the year following, roughly at 9%, then 8% in that magnitude. Those are very large deficits. A lot of stimulus, like I said, will be coming online 1 or 2 years from now. And at the same time, the Fed will have to pull back at that moment. So what you can expect there is an enormous fight between the Federal Reserve, the administration, and Congress probably. Congress has to run for office next year. The president wants to have his long-term changes in place, more education, healthcare for all, more environmental regulation, more spending on research, and so on. All those are long-term projects. They will hit the economy 2-3 years from now, just as all that monetary stimulus that the Fed had been pumping in starting last year will also still be very effective. Now, can you see a Federal Reserve chairman who will be really stepping on the brakes while the government is going full steam ahead? You know one person like that, and that was Chairman Volcker back in the early 80s. He stepped on the brakes not once, but twice. The prime rate was at 20%, in case you forgot, and the economy was thrown twice into a recession, back to back. But he had the full support of President Reagan at that time. Well, Reagan had not appointed Volcker. That was Carter who did that. But he had the full support of Reagan, and Reagan said, we want to get inflation under control. Okay, you tell me whether the chairman of the Federal Reserve, whoever that may be, and Bernanke's job is up January 1st of next year. His term is up as chairman, not as a governor. But his term is up, and first question is, will he be reappointed? Right. Second, if not, he will be replaced by whom? And will that person, appointed by the current president, have the fortitude to really tighten the monetary conditions again when it needs to be done, unless you want to have high inflation, which will wipe out your savings again, especially if you've been running into long-term treasury bonds for safety? That will be the next thing that will be hit as interest rates spike. So beware of that coming bubble.
I think you answered a question about what T-bills should we invest in, and what types of stocks will best weather this coming crisis?
Let me say one more word on what T-bills should I invest in. They are the so-called inflation-protected securities, and they will increase in value as inflation kicks up. So that is a good, safe investment that will protect you against inflation. You're not going to get a high rate of return, but you will get inflation protection. Your principal will be safeguarded. What stocks should I invest in? I'm the world's worst stock picker, so please don't ask me that question. My answer will be invest in a broad portfolio of stocks, an efficiently managed exchange-traded fund that is broadly based, and you are participating in the overall recovery of the U.S. economy. I think it would be very difficult to pick individual winners and losers. Just think, any sector you want to have. Today, I think it was ExxonMobil, increase its dividend. Well, if the administration will succeed in all its programs with energy savings and things like that, will that be a good investment? Who knows? There are some arguments for it, some arguments against it. Same in the healthcare sector. The administration says we want to spend more on healthcare, but will individual healthcare companies benefit from it? Or will the administration throttle back, let's say, on Medicare reimbursements, impose price controls on drugs, things of that sort? Those are all very much open questions which will influence the stocks sharply one way or another. And anybody who says, well, this stock is a sure winner, that stock is a sure loser, I think it's a very difficult thing to say. So broad-based exchange-traded funds that have low cost.
Not the final question, but almost. What are the most important signs to watch for significant improvement in the economy?
Well, first of all, the stock market is a very good sign to watch because the stock market is a forward-looking market, and it essentially tries to value how much these companies will be earning in the future years. How much will their income stream be worth? And then you can devise very fancy cash flow models that will tell you how much that stock should be worth right now. So those are the expectations that are embedded in the forward-looking market. So if you want to see whether the economy is improving, look at the stock market. Don't look at unemployment numbers. Unemployment tends to be a trailing index.
Those
would be probably the two most important ones.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one more question. So you've described your vision today, the three steps. How will your suggestions be heard by Obama and Washington?
I have no clue. We are 3,000 miles away from Washington. I hope he's listening to this broadcast. I hope Nancy Pelosi, who just spoke here 2 weeks ago, will carry the message because she's certainly one of the Commonwealth Club fans. And I think all of you can write your congressman, send a message, and say, vote for PI, the Prudent Investors Exchange. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Robert Heller, former governor of the Federal Reserve Board, as well as former president of Visa USA. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thanks so much.
Excellent.